On the morning of December 16th, 1960, two airplanes, one an old TWA plane bound for LaGuardia Airport, the other a state-of-the-art United turbojet headed to Idlewild, collided in the fog over New York City. The flaming wreckage from one of the planes landed in the so-called transitional neighborhood of Park Slope, Brooklyn, destroying several buildings, including the Pillar of Fire Church.
The church is completely demolished. Several other buildings are completely afire, and very heavy smoke is blanketing the entire area.
The New York Times ran a triple banner headline and described what was then the worst air disaster in American history, more than 130 dead both in the air and on the ground. 50 years later, the New York Times is once again covering the story. A handful of staff members are walking the streets, literally re-reporting the events of that day. Overseeing the project is Wendell Jameson, deputy metro editor for NYTimes.com. He says disaster coverage has come a long way. Wendell, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So let's talk first about the people who died that day. What sort of details were published in the paper?
People on that plane included businessmen, college students, a little boy named Stephen Boltz, who was the only survivor. And the newspapers that covered the disaster listed all their names and in some cases explained why they were on the plane. But there was no sense of who these people were. Today, if something like this would happen at the New York Times or at any of the newspapers I've worked for, you'd really strive to do a portrait of these people's lives. What we did in the case of Stephen Boltz, the survivor, was really report out his life in great, great detail, not just why he was on the plane or what happened to him after he was thrown from the plane, but his life making model airplanes at home and being in the Boy Scouts and going camping with his family.
Now, Stephen didn't live long after that crash.
That's right. He lived until the next morning. And the whole city and perhaps the whole country kind of watched him very closely. He was the one little bit of good news from this horrible story. And so for a lot of people, it was a real crushing second tragedy when he died the next day.
Why do you think it's de rigueur now in journalism to sketch the biographies of people who die in major disasters? Did it start with the Times, with 9/11 and the portraits of grief, which were portraits of the people who died in the towers, and you were part of that?
I was. I was the editor of that. It didn't start with that, but that might be one of the largest examples of this form. Every day we put in the names of someone who died in Afghanistan or Iraq, and often the people who die then become the focus of larger feature stories. It's a big challenge, but I just think it's important to do because otherwise it's just a bunch of numbers, and it's very hard to really experience what has been lost here if you don't know these people.
So how are you doing that for a 50-year-old tragedy?
Well, in the case of Stephen, who's the one we really focused on, David Dunlap, a real premier writer at the New York Times, spent many weeks getting to know his family. Stephen's younger brother, William, has never really spoken of this. He's still quite haunted by it. But in the end, he agreed to be interviewed just by email by David. And his response turned out to be more than 3,000 words long and is an absolutely beautiful essay about his little brother and about that time in America and in growing up in Illinois. I run a blog called City Room with Andy Newman, who's the bureau chief, and we have no limitations of space, as one would in the newspaper, so we're just going to run the whole essay, 3,000 words. You really walk away knowing this kid as a living, breathing, great little boy and not a tragic, burned figure.
Full disclosure, I've lived in Park Slope since 1995, and even briefly on the very corner of Sterling and 7th Avenue where the wreckage fell. It's kind of interesting. You discovered from going back over the old coverage that there was a coded description of that neighborhood back in 1960.
I, by the way, moved to Park Slope with my parents in 1969 and lived there until I went to college in the early 80s. And I lived on St. John's Place around the corner and was also always fascinated by this. And yes, the newspapers called it a neighborhood in transition. You can't see me, but I'm making that little quotation mark with my fingers. It was a rough neighborhood. And Emily Rube, one of our writers, did a story looking at Park Slope in 1960 before the plane came down. And I think it would really surprise many people who live there now. It's really a very beautiful and very upscale neighborhood.
But it was featured in a film in the 70s, a film called The Landlord, as the quintessential New York slum.
Yes, I've seen that. And it was a rough neighborhood. And Emily found stories about a shop owner of a florist who kept a bottle of lye under the counter to throw in the face of robbers who came in. And people described houses on St. John's Place as looking like a bomb had gone off. You know, this is before the plane came down. There was a lot of white flight to the suburbs. banks would not give mortgages to people who wanted to live there, and also real estate agents who wanted to buy buildings and chop them up into rooming houses would try and sort of scare the residents with sort of racially coded discussions, you know, oh, this neighborhood's really getting worse, you better sell now. But nobody really explored that day what this neighborhood was going through. So we sort of re-reported that world, and you'd learn more from Emily's story than about Park Slope than you would of any of the stories at the time.
Do you think today we would have similar kinds of teachable moments about neighborhoods that hosted disasters?
Absolutely. Several years ago, there was a terrible fire in the Bronx, and 10 children were killed. I helped run that coverage on the Metro section of the Times, and we really looked at this community. We looked at the type of housing stock that's there and how some of it is not inspected properly and let this fire happen. So we used this disaster as a way to show the city this whole world. And it was great journalism to be part of, and you didn't really see that in the Park Slope coverage at the time. Another fascinating thing is we have some radio from then that talks about the plane crash live, and none of the reporters say what neighborhood it is. They just say, we're in Brooklyn.
We're talking to you from the scene of the plane crash in Brooklyn. At the corner of 7th Avenue and Sterling Place, or at least 200 feet from that corner.
They don't know what neighborhood it is. They've never been there. They got there. They looked at the street sign. And even in the newspapers, it does mention Park Slope, but only fleeting.
So we've talked about changes in the way we report the who of disasters and also the where. Let's talk about now the most stark difference between then and now, which is the why.
Absolutely. It's fascinating to read the descriptions of why these two planes came down. The United plane was a DC-8 jet headed to Idlewild. The Lockheed Constellation was a TWA plane. It was going to LaGuardia.
Both airports were in Queens. The airport then called Idlewild is now called Kennedy Airport.
That's correct. You know, the newspapers at the time that I've seen didn't really try and find out themselves why this had happened. They accepted this report from the government. The jet overshot its holding pattern. One of its transponders was out, so it didn't know where it was. Oh, well, you almost have the sense of reading it. You know, this stuff happens with those crazy things flying around up in the sky. Nobody stopped and said, wait a minute, how could a plane so easily overshoot its holding pattern? And Patrick McGeehan, who was a reporter at the Times, who did the story about this aspect of it for our series, learned that at the time, there were no speed limits on jet planes. Jet passenger planes were new. He was going 600 miles an hour over New York City. So when he overshot his holding pattern, before he even knew it, he had overshot it by 12 miles. I think today, rather than wait for the government to tell us what had happened and just accept that as the final word and move on, you know, we dig very hard to figure out, well, are these rules even appropriate? Do we need to do more? And indeed, in time, this crash did lead to all sorts of rules about speed flying over urban areas.
You're publishing some of these stories in the actual paper and all of them on the City Room blog. Why devote so many resources to something that happened 50 years ago? Did you have a conversation with your bosses about this?
I told Joe Sexton, the Metro editor, what I wanted to do. He said, great, sounds terrific. I will admit that some of the reporters have become so passionate about this project that it got bigger than I had initially planned. Emily Rube, our producer, has created all of this multimedia stuff, including audio from that time and interviews with people who remember it. And, you know, just today, Andy Newman did a great story walking around Park Slope, looking at signs of the crash that still linger. And it's a wonderful story because it begins describing, you know, there's a cornice missing from one apartment building because the plane's wing hit that building. And there's a modern building on one corner because the brownstone that was there 50 years ago burned to the ground. And these are sort of things you would expect. But Andy walks you down Sterling Place and eventually takes you into the backyard of a house where a guy has a huge piece of the jet still sitting there that no one ever collected. It's really amazing.
How long before the New York Times of 1960 moved on from this story?
Oh, that's an interesting question. Literally the next day, I believe, there was a fire in a aircraft carrier at the Brooklyn Navy Yard in which 49 people were killed. Another huge story. And our plane crash disappears from coverage, not only in the Times, but in the Daily News and the Herald Tribune and the World Telegram and other papers I've looked at. It's gone. A week later, the report comes out. This is what we think happened. They did that story. Maybe 6 months later, the bigger report from the Civilian Aeronautical Board came out. They reported that story. But boy, did it fade fast. If that were to happen today, God forbid, I could guarantee you weeks of coverage in the Times and the other local newspapers.
Any other decades-old news planned for the paper?
No, I'm taking a break from 1960 New York when we're done with this, and I'm coming back to the present.
I hear some really cool things happened in 1896.
Yes, well, maybe we'll do 1896 Day on the City Room blog, and we'll write as they used to then and have only engravings and Gothic type on all the stores.
Wendell, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Wendell Jamison is deputy metro editor for nytimes.com. He oversees the City Room blog, where all of the news reporting about the 1960 plane crash in Park Slope can be found.
The police and fire department are having a difficult time in keeping crowds away from the scene, and even the press, because of the extent of the damage, is held at some distance from the scene, so we cannot give you an accurate report.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, and Sarah Abdurrahman, with help from Nerida Brownlee, and edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Dylan Keefe and Rob Granis.
Andy Lancet is WNYC's archivist. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Ellen Horn is WNYC's senior director of national programs and the wind beneath our wings. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there. You can find us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is Ira Flatow, host of Science Friday. For over 30 years, the Science Friday team has been reporting high-quality science and technology news, making science fun for curious people by covering everything from the outer reaches of space to the rapidly changing world of AI to the tiniest microbes in our bodies. Audiences trust our show because they know we're driven by a mission to inform and serve listeners first and foremost with important news they won't get anywhere else. And our sponsors benefit from that halo effect. For more information on becoming a sponsor, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.